Off the Ball, GAA.
No motivation. We've a crowd of fellas down there that are training since last November, and obviously we addressed it at the start about the All-Ireland final last year, and that back of the head straight away then after that.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast
with Viagra Connect 50 milligram film coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
Yeah, you just have to be there.
You know, yeah, to be there.
And it was just great to say, like, all right, I was there for that. You know what I mean?
You have to be there.
I wish I wasn't there.
You have to be there.
Yes, we are going on air show. How are you? Good morning to you. Joe McGuckin is this week's You Had To Be There. One of two this week.
Yes, yeah. We had Lee Cronin of Lee Cronin's The Mummy, the Irish director.
I know Lee, yeah.
There you
what
go.
A legend. What a step down now to have me.
No. This has been weeks. This is weeks in the making, isn't
has
it?
Has Lee been in already?
He was in yesterday. His one has gone out tomorrow. We pre-recorded it.
Right, okay.
It'll be live tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay.
Just like, this is live now.
But yours is live now.
Oh, this is really live. Yeah, don't swear.
Yes. Oh, you can swear.
You can actually an extent. Now, we're a bit harsher on each other with that.
What are you talking about?
You're stricter.
He drops C-bombs randomly.
No.
With young kids in the car listening of a morning.
Yeah.
And then he's unapologetic about it. I swear like a sailor, but that's, you know.
Yeah, obviously.
A friendly sailor.
Incredibly hypocritical from the man there in the other chair.
When I said
a word, it was a quote of another person, which wasn't actually me saying it. I was playing in character, if you will.
Of course. I know all about that.
So you're a writer, comedy writer, podcaster, producer,
are you just trying to figure it out, or
what's
that's an introduction?
What's the
what are you?
That is every. You can correctly label you with all of those titles. Would that be fair?
I suppose.
One more food truck entrepreneur.
That's right. Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
In research, I heard you talk to another former guest on this very slot, Mark Mariarty, who did his "You Had to Be There," and I thought you were joking with the way you delivered that. I also have a food truck, and I was waiting for ages. Like, is this real? Is this legitimate?
And that was at the end of it. That Mark Moriarty's podcast was a food podcast, and he completely missed his research. Completely missed the fact that I have a food company. That just does spice bags now. In fairness, but yeah, I do.
Because you wanted to bring the spice bag to Coolock, where you moved to.
I moved to Coolock, and there's literally nowhere out there that does a good spice bag. So I decided I'll just make my own, and then I started a business. I wanted it to be an ice cream truck. And just kind of go around street to street with spice girls playing, "Stick it in a lad, spice up your life." And everyone would be like, "Oh, it's the spice bag truck." And then they'd run out. But, you know, you can't do that legally, unfortunately.
Because you looked into that.
Yeah. I did. I genuinely did. So many emails sent.
Where does the entrepreneurial spirit come from? Because a lot of people, if they were disgruntled with no spice bags in Coolock, they would just continue to look for places that have spice bags.
Or take to social media, give out about it and do nothing.
So where does that come from?
I just think I have deeply ingrained bitterness in me, and it's not a desire to succeed. It's not the entrepreneurial spirit, it's just a spiteful spirit.
Larry David has a spice shop in Curb Your Enthusiasm.
The coffee shop, spice shop, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Maybe that's where I got it from.
but where do you actually get it from, all this proactivity in your life to have those labels associated with you there a few seconds ago, and then to have this on the side, which you wouldn't think would make any sense considering how busy you are, because I know you have your home life as well.
Yeah,
Where's the motivation come from?
I guess I don't have a full-time job, so the devil makes, you know, I have idle times, a lot of time on my hands. I don't have a lot of time on my hands, but I'm able to commit myself to doing whatever I say that I want to do. Like, the spice bag truck kind of spun out from the podcast, the Stala podcast, where I was talking about no spice bags in Coolock. And they were like, "Well, then do it yourself." And then I was like, "Yeah, we're all right. I will do it. Because I do hate when people say that they're going to do something, or, "Oh, you could do that," or, "I could do this," and then they don't do it. I just like proving to yourself that you can do something as well, without getting too real about it.
No, this is the bit of the show where we're allowed to get real. Can you spool back a bit, though, and not having a full-time job is kind of a lifestyle career choice. When did you start deciding that actually you didn't want to do that stuff and you wanted to get into, is comedy first, writing first?
for me, writing, yeah. I love writing. I love the process of creating an idea and developing it and then seeing it come to life.
You kind of start that stuff when you're 10, 11, 12, really. Like, I know people dismiss childhood writing, but that's when you start loving reading and writing, isn't
it? Yeah, I'd say so. I loved it. I loved writing. I loved reading books. I loved making comics in school. And I just loved the whole process. And that's kind of where it came out for
me.
Did
someone encourage you at that point?
No. Nobody really encouraged. I suppose I done school plays, and that was kind of the first time I got a bit of praise for creativity. You know, everyone, even in my family, they'd slag me for making YouTube videos. So, I've played Steven Spielberg over here. And, you know, nobody would really take it seriously. So the first time someone did take it seriously and give me some recognition or praise would have been in primary school doing Oliver Twist, like a school play. And that left like a really positive imprint on me growing up. And I feel like I've been chasing that feeling ever since. So I think that's why I do what I do.
This is a very South County Dublin wanker question, but where did you go to school?
O'Connell's in Summerhill.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there was a teacher there, obviously, who put you in the play and gave you the praise.
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually been looking for him. His name was Mr. Kilroy, and he was the English teacher, but he also done all the drama. And he actually, from that play, then he brought me to do Fiddler on the Roof in a college play as well, and even that made me feel like, oh, I'm good, I'm so good that I'm being uplifted to a different level. And I just found that really exciting, and that's kind of, yeah, the praise that you get.
I just think that education is unbelievably important and could actually really help us fix all of the problems that we have in the world, and it's mad that you've gone from that one thing to being this successful entrepreneur who's capable of doing so many different things. And I often wonder sometimes if people don't get this opportunity or they don't get that little bit of a shunt in the right direction, who knows where things go. I mean, you probably would have made it anyway, right? But maybe not, you know, maybe...
Maybe, I don't think so. I honestly think, like, from the area that I came from, I always say this, like, I could have easily went down a different path and the wrong road, if you will, if anyone showed any interest in me. Like, if a drug dealer came up to me and was like, hey, do you want to carry these drugs up the road? I'd be like, yeah. And then if they said,
here's
that
a scooter.
That was great. You've done brilliant at that job. I'd be like, really? Okay. Like, I really embraced the praise that I got. Even, I think I'd done two boxing classes in Corinthians Boxing Club, and I really felt good about myself because we were like, oh yeah, I like your movement. And then I was like, oh, okay, I can do this. I'm a professional boxer now. So I think I in my earlier years, I kind of thrived on prayers.
So Fiddler on the Roof, when you say it's a college thing, is it like you're not still in school, or you're still in school, but it's actually an older production and they need a young person in it?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I was an extra.
Right.
But I was like a child. I didn't have a name or anything, but even just being...
You're suddenly around a production.
Yeah.
It demystifies that whole thing. You get to walk in and go, I'm here on purpose. And they all talk to each other. I can talk to them.
And they're real actors. It's like these are grown-up actors and you're kind of in the environment and you're like, wow, this is... You feel like you're part of it then. You're kind of seeing behind the curtain a little bit. And it was exciting, especially for the child to have that experience.
Knowing all that now, right? How are you not pissed off about... Or maybe you are very pissed off about like social deprivation and the fact that so many of your contemporaries didn't get that same opportunity or have... It seems like the greatest wasted talent that we have in Ireland is like not understanding all this great talent that we have.
In what sense? Can you elaborate a little bit more on it?
Does it feed a social or an anger or any of that kind of sense that like, you know, everybody in your class could have had a similar positive outcome if they'd been helped along the way?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people did. Like, I grew up in the same flats, in the same, like, I grew up with Barry Keoghan. We were in the same film club in our youth club. Like, there was three or four youth clubs around that area. So I understand when people say that it's a deprived area and stuff, because it is in many ways. But also, we take care of each other, and there is a lot of support, but there also is... You know, there's negatives. Obviously, there's negatives because of a history of deprivation, but I don't know if the deprivation is still there.
Okay.
More can still be done, but there is a lot of care and attention to the community.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, if you look at Portland Row just by itself, the Golden Mile, like everyone that came from that area, and it might be in spite of their upbringing, and they might be the exception to the rule, but there's still, I think there's so much support. Like, even, I know I was saying that people would slag me for making the videos, but there's still, when I was making the comedy sketches, people that would share them on social media said, that's Joe McGuck and I know him from the area. And yeah, there's a pride, there's an ownership then. And that's, you can't get that anywhere else. I don't know, like, if you have that same support in South County Dublin, like, I don't know.
When you were labelled Steven Spielberg,
yeah,
for having the audacity to create something like that, so that
press
was
record, yeah,
that was within you, was it? So was there a creativity within, do you think?
I think I don't, not any more than there is in anyone else. I don't think, I don't know. I'd be too humble to say yes, that's within me, because I think it's in everyone. I think my whole family, like, I think my older brother is funnier than I am. I think there's better performers in my family. I think it's in so many people, but they just don't choose to take it seriously and to pursue it as a career.
If you weren't encouraged, do you think you would have stopped?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I would have stopped. I feel like so many points along my path, there was obstacles. And even now, I still feel like there's obstacles. But there's so many points where you want to just kind of give up and say, what am I doing? Well, this is stupid. Sometimes I was an extra in a friend's short film and I was in a chicken costume. And I was in like the green room and I was sitting there for about 6 hours and I'm just looking at myself and I'm thinking, I have two kids. This is my job. What am I doing? Like, sometimes you feel stupid. It's a silly career path to be in. Comedy in general, but then like the film industry in Ireland is so small. It's so challenging. That's why you can't just be an actor, or you can't just be a writer. You're going to have to be everything. Like, there's a director, like Lee Cronin probably talked about it, which is, but there's a director, a good friend of mine, he's a director and he's well established, but he also paints the sets of other TV shows. And he's like, on the weekend, he's producing really big films, and in the weekdays, he's painting sets. Like, it's really hard to just be one thing.
Lee said he was totally broke at one point and was like, well, put a fiver in the car because that's what I can afford. And now he's making 150 million for Warner Brothers when he's making his movies, and he has his name in the title of it. But
yeah,
like, that's, in a way, that's the commitment that you make as an artist, that at some point this is going to happen for me. And if it doesn't, I really love the work anyway, even when I'm sitting in a chicken costume.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know about that day in particular, but in general, yeah. In general, you're just kind of like, even doing the podcast, and then you're just sitting backstage in Vicar Street, there's just pinch me moments where you're just like, I'm out of selling out Vicar Street. Like, this is crazy.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, like, the moment in the chicken costume when you're in the green room, why am I doing this? I was going to ask, could you give me an example of when you thought, yeah, this is what I do?
Yeah.
That's Vicar Street, is it?
Vicar Street was one of them. The day that I met Lee Cronin, actually, funny enough that we're talking about him, I was in LA. I had a radio show with Spin 103.8 and they sent us to Hollywood when...
For the Oscars.
When Ireland took over the Oscars, yeah, basically. And we snuck into the Oscar Wilde party over there, which is the Irish celebration, like... So you have to be Irish to get into it. There's other people. But anyway, we weren't invited, so we decided to sneak in, and we got in the back way by saying that we were the Coronas. I said, they were like, can we get your name? They had a list, and I was like, I'm from the Coronas. I'm Danny from the Coronas. And then they were like, there's a photograph and everything besides the names. I looked nothing like them. But they went, yeah, okay, go on in. And we were in there, and there's all of these A-list celebrities. And then we went out to the smoking area in the back just to kind of take a breather. I say, we did it. We actually got in. And Lee was there. And that's how I met Lee.
Right.
And he was like, oh, no way. I seen your sketch. I can't remember what it was. Git. I don't know if you remember the Git sketch.
Yeah.
But they were like, oh, I seen that sketch. And then that's how we got talking to Lee. But that was a pinch me moment being at the Oscars at that party.
We had Darren Conway in to do his own episode of this. Yet to be there. And so a lot of people know you as part of that duo. But it goes way beyond. You have your series at RTE, which is hugely popular.
Yeah.
On The Player, isn't it?
Free Gaff. We have two seasons of Free Gaff. And I don't know if it still is, but at the time, it was the most watched RTE Player series, original series, which was incredible as well. But even working on that, being able to sit in a room for a month and write sketches... That was actually, I had a full-time job working in Boyle Sports, the betting company. Don't know if I'm allowed, can I say that?
Yeah. What did you do for them?
I was their social media manager.
Okay. Ah.
So I was in charge of their content and creating sketches and stuff for them.
Were you appearing in those sketches?
Yes.
You were, okay.
I was doing everything. Right. I was setting the cameras up. It was during COVID, so it was really exhausting and draining. And then a lot of stuff, I think my dad passed away during that time and... I couldn't get a lot of time off for the funeral, and there was a lot of stuff going on in my life that I said, you know what, I'm just going to pack this in. And it helped that we had Free Gaff at the time as well, so I could leave that and just back myself, take a punt on myself and go full time doing the comedy stuff. So that's what happened when we were doing Free Gaff. But that was amazing, working with all the comedians, all the guests that we had on that.
When did you realise that you can make a living out of everything that we've talked about so far?
I'm still trying to figure out if I can. I don't know. When we done Free Gaff, we also got an opportunity to do the podcast. So between the podcast and the RTE series and some brand work that I was doing, I said to the missus, or the missus actually said to me, it's not worth it. Like, it was taking a... It was taking a toll on my mental health. And she said, you know what, just do it. And if it doesn't work in a year, you can just get another job. Just get a job then. So just kind of take a year off.
What was it specifically that was taking a toll on your mental health?
My dad died.
That was it.
We had a second kid. Our first kid, the birth was traumatic. And then the second kid was also traumatic. So that kind of brought everything back to the surface. And then when my dad passed, and... There was just and COVID just in general, like lockdown, and my head was just all over the place.
Yeah.
And I went to A&E, checked into A&E and stuff for suicidal tendencies, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me in terms of breaking me back for companies that don't actually, you know, care about you as much as you care about yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, does it?
Yeah, totally, yeah.
Okay, you're handing in your notice now.
Is there a... Well, when does a recovery start? Because sometimes doing the hard part is actually checking yourself in. And in a way, it's quite a symbolic thing, right? But actually, it's not like it's a sudden massive release.
No.
The release has to come with a lot of hard work after that.
Yeah. And that's hard. Like, that would, you know, it's weird thinking back to and putting myself in that, in the headspace that I was in. But what kind of got me through was sort of the experiences afterwards and how much of a disaster the health system is going through it. Like, I went to see, I don't even know what he was. It was a therapist, a psychologist or a therapist or something, but he was in just in a health centre out in Coolock. And he brought me in. This was an assessment to get antidepressant medication, Cetraline. And I was telling him everything that I went through. It was like, oh, my brother passed away, my dad passed away, my son, I have all this guilt, I have all this baggage and stuff like that. And then I looked up and your man was sitting in his chair and he was asleep. No, I was like, oh my Jesus. And they had somebody in that was they had someone that was in there training, and he had said to me at the start, like, do you mind if he sits over there? He's just taking notes, like, he's training. And I was like, oh, right, yeah, yeah, okay. So then when I looked up and he was asleep, I looked over at the trainee, or whatever, probably a student or something like that. And then he was like, he was shrugging his shoulders, like, I don't know. What the fuck's going on? And I was like, this is crazy. This is insane. And I don't know, it just kind of made... I mean, I got sertraline then after that. That didn't help me. Like, I'm not here advocating antidepressant medications because it didn't work for me. It probably made me worse in some ways. And yeah, I don't know.
How did it make you worse? Like, kind of zoned out and...
Yeah.
The feelings became inaccessible and therefore you couldn't deal with them?
No, I think everything became inaccessible and nothing... It just made me numb to... I didn't feel the needs to kill myself.
Yeah.
But I also didn't feel happiness or love or anything. I just kind of felt glazed over or something. And I didn't feel creative. I didn't feel funny.
Yeah.
It just made me, I don't know, it kind of locked me and trapped me in or something like that. And not in a claustrophobic way either. Just kind of, I was content doing nothing. But then I wasn't content being content.
Yeah.
So I stopped taking them. There was other experiences that really helped me. I don't know. Other substances.
Oh, yeah.
That were really helpful for me.
Mushrooms, MDMA?
Mushrooms, yeah. Magic mushrooms. I'd done a retreat. It's like a 2-day retreat, and I really went deep on myself. And
that
instantly, that changed everything.
Wow.
Completely opened a different door for me that I was able to go through and... understand everything that was complete. It just shifted my perspective on everything that was making me feel awful, and I feel so much better even to today.
Right,
it was so life changing.
That has stayed with you. That ability to have that shift in perception.
Yeah,
you've carried that.
So I still need to check in with myself from time to time, but like absolutely, the things that were holding me back, I see them. Like with my dad, like I felt guilt about my dad when he died. I felt guilt about my brother when he died. I felt guilt about the birth of my two sons. I felt guilt about just being selfish and just...
Your brother, what was the guilt?
Well, the last time I met my brother, like he was addicted to stuff and he robbed my bike. And so then he came back that night and he wasn't with it and I fought him. And we were living in the flats and I like kicked him out of the house and I kicked him down the stairs and I threw his clothes over the balcony to him and it was raining and he was saying the whole time, like, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I believe that he was like, and then he went into treatment after that. But after his treatment, he went to live with somebody else and passed away in the house there. But the last time I ever met him or seen him, that was awful. That's an awful memory that I had of my brother. But like when I took the mushrooms, I seen that whole experience from his perspective and it changed my view on
what
how I
doing.
Remember. Yeah, and what I was doing, yeah.
In that it was an act of love.
I seen it from his point of view, which meant I felt forgiveness for me. Like he was saying sorry to me.
Okay.
And so he doesn't hold that against me. That's kind of how I feel now about that whole experience.
Yeah.
Still feel a bit of guilt, feel bad, but it doesn't eat me up as much as it did back then. And also with my dad, he had a stroke and he was in hospital, but because of COVID, we could never see him. And then he died in a care home. Like the last year of his life, he was pretty much alone, which is
heartbreaking.
And you carry a lot of guilt for that. So that shifted my perspective on that. And, you know, it changed my perspective on that. And the same with my son, I felt guilt for even getting my wife pregnant, for her putting her through that. And then for bringing him into the world and putting him through that. And there's just, I just kind of felt it's my fault. Everything bad that happens in my life is my fault. and the mushrooms kind of just pushed all that to the side.
It was a big decision to get off the antidepressants, I'd say, was it? Because was that the first time since starting to take them that you felt anxiety because of what might happen if you go back off them?
No, I didn't. I didn't have a problem coming off them, and I was taking a high dose as well of sertraline. And they say, like, you know, you're supposed to wean yourself off it, but I just didn't feel any benefit at all. So I was like, what am I doing this for? And I was going to therapists. That wasn't working. I was doing, there's a therapy where you do eye movements. I can't remember what that's called. It's not CBT. It's a different thing. But I even felt when I was doing that, the therapist was saying, now, how do you feel? Do those memories feel a bit faded? And I was like, they didn't, but I didn't want him to feel bad. So I was just like, yeah, I get it. This is amazing. I'll see you next week.
The Irish male lying to their doctor about being okay. It's like, that's a bad national trait we have.
Do you know what I mean?
I'm grand. I'm dying.
Yeah, I feel so much better now. Thank you. It's like when the waiter comes off to check on how your food is and you've just been given out about it. Like, this is crap. Oh, yeah, it's lovely. This is nice. Thank you.
The mirror behind in the haircut. How is it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
That's where we come from, a culture of, oh, you're grand.
Yeah. I don't want to cause
you can't give out. That'll be your reputation. Nobody wants it in Ireland.
No.
It's terrible.
I mean,
there's a lot of pain walking around that people try to cover.
Yeah. Some people EMDR? Are better
at it. Is that EMDR? Yeah. EMDR. That's the one. Yeah. Yeah. Did you?
No, somebody,
you
Matthew
got,
outside.
You got producers in there doing the read. Love yeah, it. Yeah. Love it. EMDR. Yeah. It's crazy. Maybe it works for some people, but it definitely wasn't for me.
When did this all happen? When what timeline are we talking here when your brother passes away and you're in the A&E, your dad passes away and then you switch from antidepressants to mushrooms? What are we talking here?
My brother passed in 2016 and then my son was born in 2018 and then my second son was born in 2021 and that's the same year that my dad passed as well. And then lots of other, like, they're kind of the major trauma points. But then, like, you go back even deeper and stuff that happened as a kid. And it's not even, yeah, just it's the trauma even of not my brother dying, but, like, when he was alive and dealing with addiction. Even not with, like, my dad was addicted to alcohol and a lot of people in my family addicted to alcohol. And it is... There's lots of little trauma points, but there are four of the major trauma points, I think.
Mm.
But there's loads, yeah, loads. And just growing up in you know, the NRC can be hard in general. And you don't realise it until you kind of look back and reflect and say, that was kind of weird. That was a bit mad.
Because you also talk about it like, at the time you didn't think it was anything too bad because it's a real community aspect to it. And you were actually lamenting that when you went to Coolock, that in the suburbs you wouldn't be as connected as you once were to your neighbours.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, even now, I don't know my neighbours and I've been living in Coolock now for... since 2018. So...
The neighbour two doors up, you might not know.
No, don't know their name.
But in Summerhill, you'd all know each other.
Ah, yeah, you'd know everyone. The flat, it'd be just like one big family. I don't think it's like that anymore.
Right.
I think with social media and stuff, people don't need that human connection, or they feel like they don't need that human connection. And maybe it spun out from gossip, like standing on the balcony drinking cups of tea. But wherever the reason, it felt like a community. It felt like you knew people. Like my ma, like to be kids on the balcony, and my ma knew how to do French plaits.
Oh, yeah.
And the school morning, every morning, the kids would be coming in to do French plaits and the ma's would be coming in having a cup of tea. Come on, you're right, Ari. Who's bringing the kids down? Who's picking the kids up? Like, it was, you had like 50 ma's. It was crazy. Amazing. I feel sorry that my kids don't have that. But then I also feel happy that they don't have the life that I had growing up. So it's a bit of give and take.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does all day long. The brother that you said you thought was funnier than you, was that your brother who passed away?
I do think he was funnier than me, but my brother that's alive now, I think he's very funny. I think he's way funnier than I am, yeah.
Did people think you were funny growing up?
I tried to be funny because I wasn't athletic and I wasn't like incredibly smart or I wasn't like, I tried to, yeah, I think so. I think so. Yeah. I hope so. They laughed.
Cause, no, because like my entry into your work, if you want to call it that, was like, oh, this guy is like one of our like great modern absurdist humorists. And it was like, you can just get lost with Joe and his sketches and it's great. Like, and he's like, you are like an escape a lot of the time when you're watching your sketches. That's what I thought for you. I thought, like, this guy's really funny.
Yeah.
And then you delve a bit deeper and it's like, Jared asked you the question earlier and you were talking, well, it's a writer. Writer really is what your thing is. And then you wrote this amazing short film called Home Time. Am I right in saying it's loosely based on your childhood?
Yeah. Yeah, but, I mean, not specifically mine. I think a lot of people can relate to it.
Yeah, just loads of depth there, and it's like, Jesus Christ, this is a completely other side to this guy that I thought of.
Yeah, I mean, it's loosely based on my childhood in the sense that I was a child growing up in the 90s and spent a lot of time in pubs.
So did I remember that as well. Yeah.
Where'd you grow up?
I'm Cork.
Right, okay. Yeah. And do you have pubs there?
We did, yeah. We had a few, yeah, in the 90s. That's why we frequented them. It was such a novel thing.
Yeah.
So we
yeah.
went there. But I remember, like, when I was watching it, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, this kind of brings me back, all right. Because I think I'm right in saying that you initially wrote that as a comedy, that it was going to be like, it was songs, and then you realised this isn't that funny.
Yeah, I was actually preparing for a live show for the Stala podcast and I was thinking, I usually do a song at the live shows, and I was writing a song. I was like, do you remember in the 90s having a packet of Crips and a drink in the corner? And I was struggling to find the punchline. It was like, oh yeah, okay, it's very observational. That did happen. But then I was thinking, it's not that funny. And I was actually, it's kind of sad actually. It's really sad. I went into the kitchen then. I put the guitar down and I went into the kitchen and I wrote the first draft, which was the final draft, pretty much. And I sent it over to Jonathan Lambert, who directed the short film.
Yeah.
And he loved it. And he was excited by it, and I was excited by it. And you said at the start of this show, like, when you want to do something, like, don't just go do it. Like, what are you waiting for? You waiting for someone to say go for it? Waiting for a green light? Just go for it. Go and make it. And so I was lucky enough, I had a few quid in my pocket, so I was able to fund it. And I was able to call in a lot of favours from people that from the network of people that I created over the years.
Yeah, Eric Lawler's the barman.
He's the barman, yeah. Robbie is the... There's loads of people in it. Katrina O'Sullivan is an extra in it, who wrote the book Poor. There's lots of people in it.
Yeah.
Lauren Larkin. I wrote that script, and the same day that I wrote that script, I got an Instagram DM from Lauren Larkin, who's an actress. She plays the mother in it, and she's also in a bunch of other stuff. And she said to me, hey, Leon Joe, I love your stuff. If you ever want to collaborate and work on something. And I was like, let me know, she said.
Yeah.
I was like, are you for real? Like, you're amazing. And I just finished this script and you'd be perfect for it. So it just kind of felt like the stars lined up a little bit.
Yeah. I like it. I think it's going to be a very relatable short film for people who haven't seen it. Because I think a lot of people, certainly people I knew, grew up in pub culture as well. By the way, I'm not, like, I didn't have a negative experience. It's just my memory of being in pubs loads when we were kids, because that's where we'd congregate with all the adults. I think it feels like it's slightly different now in our generation of being parents that we wouldn't necessarily bring them to the pub. But like, that film shows the other side of it too, when it goes too far.
Well, that's it.
It never did for us, but I could see it happen.
Yeah, well, it did for me. Well, with the short film, I was trying to capture a feeling, and that feeling was the sense of helplessness as a child when you know the line has crossed and it's time to go home and you can't. And the film, he's saying, come on, Mark, can I go home? Because he feels unsafe, the kid feels unsafe, but he's also a kid, so he doesn't have the power yet to make choices. He can't go back by himself. He can't force his ma to go back. So he's forced to just be in that environment that he's emotionally intelligent enough to know that it's not a good environment to be in at this stage, because it's his 10th birthday.
Yeah.
So it's like, he knows it's a coming of age point, that he knows that he shouldn't be there. Or he knows that he's in a place, an environment that he's not comfortable being in. And I wanted to capture that feeling. And so when you say, is it based on your childhood? Like, that feeling, I have felt that before, and that's what I try to capture.
Yeah.
Can anybody see it now?
It's been doing the festivals for the last year. So if you were at any of the festivals, you could have caught it. But I think it's doing a couple more.
And then what's the future of a film like that?
I'm hoping to get it on RTE,
the shorts.
The shorts.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm trying to get it onto that. That'd be great. But if not, like, it'll be somewhere. I'll put it out somewhere.
The depth doesn't end there, because Beckett plays a big part in your life.
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. Samuel Beckett.
Samuel Beckett. So, what are your kids named after?
My second son is called Beckett. Yeah. Yeah. You go back to the writing and the reading and stuff. Like, I read Beckett growing up because I thought, oh, no one my age is reading Samuel Beckett.
You were right, though.
For a reason.
Yeah.
It's painful. It's painful stuff. I was forcing myself to read it. So you're talking about doing the play?
Yeah, in America.
Yeah, last year I went over to Washington, D.C. to do Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, which was...
That's incredible. How did that come about?
So I know it's kind of a long story. I'll condense it. I feel like I'm condensing everything, but like a friend of mine was doing it, and they were rehearsing in Dublin, even though it was a US production, because the main character, Barry McAvoy, he was an actor from years ago from the North, he was the main character in it, and then somebody dropped out, so the guy that I know asked me to step in. And then that guy who asked me to step in, he dropped out. And that's when the red flag started showing for me.
Why is everybody abandoning this project?
Yeah, no, this is great. I was thinking, okay, Beckett, it's challenging. They're not up for the challenge. I am. And then I ended up going to Washington, D.C. They said that we were going to be in this like mansion. We ended up in some dingy basement. And you could... Literally, there was pipes over my bed, and you could hear the turds bouncing around the pipes, the pieces of shit, and like it was dripping. It was like brown water dripping, and I was like on the ground trying to get something under the bed, and there was a rat trap underneath the bed. I was like, "This is disgusting." I was like, "This is day one over there." And then the other guy, the main character, was also in the same basement as me. And so then the next day we had to go onto the production company and said, we cannot stay here. You said that we were staying in a mansion. It's not a mansion. This is someone's basement. And there was a door as well that said, like, do not open. And they said, this is just storage. But when you open the door, the stairs upstairs. And it's like open. It's not locked or anything. Like, so anyone could just walk in. It was awful. Into my bedroom. Like, it was terrible. So then we did that.
Did you get moved?
We got moved then to a hotel, and then we got moved to an Airbnb. But then, when the actual show started, Beckett is really challenging. Any actor will tell you it's very challenging. It was challenging. The director was also in the play, and there wasn't one show that went well. There wasn't one show where he learned his entire lines. I think... We done like 40 shows, and I think we came close on the last one. And there was like 3 people in the audience. I thought we were doing it to a sold out arena.
Yeah, but sometimes it was sold out, and then sometimes it'd be 12 people.
Two times there was a sellout out of 40, which is, I mean, maybe if you combined all of the shows, we had 3 sellouts. Some nights were really bad, and there was people eating pizza in the front row, and you're trying to cry on stage. I'm like, this is hard. This is so hard. Yeah, and the guy, he's very old, like, you know what I mean? The director and actor. But it was just hell. It was hell. Absolute hell. And I was over there for a month. But yeah, I did.
Great experience.
I did it. I mean, there's so much more to it.
Why was it hell, though? Like, because the guy's forgetting his lines, and... You have to overcompensate.
I thought this was my big break. I says, I'm going to Washington. I'm going to give up my family for a month. And I hate America. First of all, like, I really despise America, let alone Washington, D.C. Like, there's nothing in Washington, D.C. There's There's nothing there. It's like crap. It's just politics. It's there's nothing there. Like the people aren't good crack. There's no nightlife. It's just office blocks.
You said it was a bit miserable.
It was bleak. It was so bleak. It just felt heavy. It felt grey. The whole time just, it felt grey. And I was on my own as well. I know I was with the other guy, but you're rehearsing and then you're doing the show. It's so intense. The amount of time that you spend together, you don't want to, you kind of want to be away as well. Mm-hmm. If you spend too much time with somebody. Yeah, no, it was just hell. But you know, it was amazing.
So next time you do Beckett, it'll be better. It can never be worse than this.
I wonder if I'll ever do Beckett again.
Are you turned off Beckett?
No, I want to do it more. Like, I want to do a bigger production of that same play, of like Waiting for Godot. It's iconic. Like, Waiting for Godot, a Samuel Beckett play, is iconic. And I played Vladimir, the co-man, and I'm really impressed with how well I done. It's just a shame that 12 people got to say it.
If a tree falls in the forest, it's like, if
does anyone hear that?
There's Beckett there for you. There, I went to Robert Sheehan.
Yeah.
And Frankie Boyle were in, I think it was Endgame.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's about 4 years ago.
Really?
And you weren't allowed to go to the Jacks, of course, during the performance. They made that very clear.
But you wouldn't dare.
And that's the problem then, when you go in and then mentally you need to go.
Yeah.
And sitting there the whole time. That was the only torture for that.
It's exhausting to even watch Beckett. Imagine performing it.
You said you weren't sporty growing up, but did you still play sport?
I wanted to. I wasn't sporty. I said that I'd done a little bit of boxing.
Yeah. And you had something.
I think so. Even with football, I felt like I had a good cross. But I didn't have boots. Me mate, like, you know, I couldn't afford boots or anything, or I couldn't afford the fees to join a club, the weekly fees, or the weekly fees for boxing or boxing gloves. Like, there's cost. I know they might seem insignificant to a lot of people, but like, the costs that go along with football's great, because all you need is a football. But if you're going to play on a team, you need to get predators and you need shin pads, and if you're going to do boxing, you need gum guards and you need boxing gloves and wraps. And you know, there is added cost to everything. So whenever I was interested in something, it didn't last too long because of that. And I was shy as well. I always felt like I was behind. There was one day, would you call it trials? I feel like people used to go for trials a lot. I went for trials for a club. And I don't know, I just was intimidated because everyone else was really good.
A club in Dublin?
Yeah. I can't remember what club it was. I think it was in Fairview. It was like East Wall or something. And yeah, everyone was already good. And I felt like I was playing catch up. So I was like, come on, I'll stay on the bench. You know what you're doing. So I loved leisure sports. I feel like I'm good at pool, darts, low cost sports, you know?
Are you a big Shells fan? Because we associate with the Chadwick ads.
Yes, I used to be bigger. I went to Shells matches when I was a kid. That'd be me club. But I didn't really follow Irish football through me late teens or early 20s. It was only really when Damien Duff came back that I got back into it. When he came back to the league, top of the league is when I got...
We get into your list? Involved.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Galway Shells is your first one. You were on a panel with Brian Kerr.
And that was an off the ball thing.
Gerard very excitedly came into the office today. It's his first pick off the ball.
Yeah. So we went to Galway to be on a panel. Shells were playing Galway. And Brian Kerr was on the panel. And I was telling him a thing or two about football. I was kind of criticising him a little bit. Like, he was giving his professional opinion, and I was giving
that team you picked against Israel. That was a terrible team. Why did you leave?
But then they asked, the reason why I put that on the list was because at the end of it, they said, okay, predictions. And I think I was the only one that said 1-1. Because Shells were on a bit of a draw streak, as they usually are.
Yeah.
Great for the draw. And I was the only one that got it right. Brian Kerr was like, oh, I think they'll get a sneaky 1-0. And I was like, you know nothing, Brian. You know nothing. There's no way Shells are going away and keeping a clean sheet.
And winning.
Yeah, and winning, yeah, yeah. So, and then there was a few other people as well. There was a couple of professionals. I don't even know why they had me on the panel. But that, yeah, that was great. That was a great experience because I got it right. And Brian Kerr, like, what a legend. That's yes. crazy.
Yeah. We get to hang out with him at festivals whenever we do a live show at Electric Picnic or
All Together Now.
Mm. Yeah. It's like, let's just book Brian because he's great crack. He loves his music.
Does he?
Loves his music.
Ah.
Yeah. Massively into it. Like, multi-generational, massive gig goer. Even when he was the Ireland manager, that was kind of one of the downsides was he couldn't go to Vicar Street as much because he'd get hassle from people.
Yeah.
But so up to that point, and then after that, they would leave him alone at gigs.
Oh, he's a legend.
You babysat Troy Parrott.
That's right. Yeah, that's my claim to fame now.
Go on.
That's my claim to fame. Well, that's when I grew up. One of my best mates was his uncle. So whenever his ma was out, we'd have to mind the kids, and he was one of the kids. And we'd be doing keepy uppies in the sitting room. I think we broke a lamp one time. Yeah.
Was he better at it than you were?
No, he wasn't. But he was like six, so I don't know how much of a... I can't really take the prize for that one.
What's your memory of him as a young fella?
Playing for quiet, as he is like now, and he just loved football. He was always class, and everyone knew he was class. It's great to see what he's doing now. I remember sitting on the bench and I found it so frustrating. I'm like, bring him on. What are you doing? Like, we don't have a... bring him. What's he doing sitting on the bench? Are you for real? Like, what's going on in training? Is he not saying this in training? Like, what is he doing on the bench? It's frustrating watching it. But now it's undeniable. Now he can't not ever start him because of what he's done.
Are you backed him, all right? You put a tenner on him?
Yeah.
For a hat-trick. Against Hungary.
Yeah.
What are the odds?
150-1. 1,500 quid back.
That's not bad.
It's all right, isn't it?
It's a good day's work.
It'd be great if they have a camera on you that, because they had a camera on you for the Czechia game, didn't they? There's a video of you reacting to penalties.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was very disappointing.
Who was videoing you?
Me missus.
I was wondering, were they not watching it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she wouldn't have been watching it. She would have been more interested in my reaction than the actual football. But yeah, that was it. Oh no, I'm thinking of the friendly. He scored a goal that would have been onside if it had went to VAR.
No. Oh, that was the most recent match. That was the North Macedonia friendly.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, I had a hat trick on him because, sure, he scored two against Portugal. And I thought, if you can score two against Portugal.
I mean, I like the logic. Yeah.
It sounds logic, isn't it? And then you'll never get him at 150-1 to score a hat trick again. I was looking at it for North Macedonia. I think it was like 30-1, something like that. Sorry, everybody.
You ruined it.
Ruined it for everyone else.
That's class that you knew from that young of an age.
Yeah.
You knew Barry Keoghan as well.
Yeah.
It's a great lineage, like.
Man, it's a great area. Mm. Like, what's come out of that area for such a small little vicinity, it's amazing. In every aspect, in comedy, in acting, sports, music.
It's hard to define it as to why these things just happen. Like, but is there something to do with the environment? Do you think is it a DIY attitude? You know, that punk ethos born out of that, isn't it? Back in the day, was do it yourself. Is that it? Because there are entrepreneurs from every background. It doesn't have to be from one particular area.
It's an entrepreneur. I mean,
well, the entrepreneurial spirit, I suppose, to go out there and make something of yourself.
I think it's just an ability to live on low income, and then you feel like you have a little bit of freedom. Like, you're not afraid of not having loads of money, and so that kind of breeds the capability to work hard on the bottom line to a point where you can actually create success. Do you know what I mean? I feel like, if you're middle class to upper class, you value money too much to the point where you won't allow yourself commit time or energy into taking something so seriously, like playing football full time. Like, no, can't go to work. I have training. Do you know what I mean? like I can't do a full time job. I can't go to college, have training. I'm doing this class, I'm acting, I'm in a film. If you're not working, or if you don't have that kind of thought process for money, then it allows you to sit at home and write music, or allows you to sit at home and be creative. There's a scheme that the government brought in. It's like the pilot scheme, the €350 artist scheme. I think that's amazing. I think every artist should have that, and that would give you the freedom and the time to pursue these creative endeavors. I think that's what it is from my area.
It's really hard to be a great artist if your environment is comfortable.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't think you've anything to draw from. I don't think you've any pain to draw from. I don't think you've any stories to draw from. I think there's a lot of middle-class filmmakers, middle to upper-class, not even middle-class, upper-class filmmakers, and they might write a story about a working-class area and it'll be crap. And you can see it. You look at it and it'll be like, well, I don't know who this is for. Is this for... it's crap. Even if... this is probably controversial, but if you look at Love Hate, season one, shy. But if you look at the later seasons, when you can see the difference in it, you can see the realism in it, the character development, even the actors that he got into it were real actors, and it felt raw, it felt real, it felt better.
Sorry, what's the difference?
It felt real. But the later seasons.
What was wrong with
did they get more?
The four seasons were like caricatures of.
This is like
Robert Sheehan.
Robert Sheehan stayed in it though, but it was Aidan Gillen.
He died, didn't he? Robert Sheehan died in the fourth season.
No, I think he was in. I think he went beyond. I think he went second or third before he was killed off, wasn't he? Yeah, because Aidan Gillen was killed off in the first season.
I mean, when they brought in.
And Brendan Gleeson's son was in it, remember? Not Donald, but.
The other fella, yeah.
Duwal.
Yeah.
Duwal.
It's not even about the actors, though. It's just about the storylines. And also partly about the actor. Like, the best actor. Elmo, brilliant in it.
Yeah.
He's also from Portland Rob. Like, amazing. And that. It feels real. Like, it feels authentic. And when it feels real and authentic, it's good.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's unfair to. It depends on what the story is. Like, obviously, middle class and upper class people can write amazing films. I just think working class people have more to draw from. A lot. Like, well, that appealed to me from that background.
Yeah.
I suppose.
I suppose, like, many like actors can inhibit different characters. They might not understand the background, but they can learn it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's what an actor's job is.
Yeah. So it can still be done, I suppose, if you don't necessarily have the background.
But I'm talking more about the writing the process, writing part, or directing, understanding.
Yeah, I suppose, like, if you think of all the, say, the great bands in music history, it's like their first two albums are great because that's where they're drawn from. And then third album onwards, or they have their money by now.
What are they writing about? Yeah. I mean, you could say the same for comedy as well. A lot of comedians kind of lose touch. The more successful they become, the more richer they become. And then some people, I don't know, I think Ricky Gervais pivots well because he's able to make fun of himself being rich now.
Yeah.
And that also appeals to, like, a wider audience.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it does. Yeah. Like, well, so Ricky Gervais had, he didn't have a job, but he was 29, he was saying. You know, he was initially, briefly a pop star.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then he was this
manager for a while, wasn't he?
I don't know, but he worked in like the inspiration from The Office is like temp jobs he used to do and taking off people.
Yeah.
But he took his time with it all. Let's go back to your time, but like, I think it's really interesting reflection on it is like, if you're comfortable, you don't give yourself the time necessarily to perfect a craft, which requires time.
Yeah.
To make you better at it. Like your decision as well to call in the full-time job and go for what you're doing now. Like that is, for a lot of people, geez, I'd never have the bravery to do that.
Very scary thing to do.
Yeah.
Very scary thing to do.
But for you, it made sense to do it.
Yeah, but it wasn't easy.
No.
It wasn't easy to do that. I, even before working in Ball Sports, I was working in a TV station and I hated that. That was like a sports TV station.
Near Stanta.
Stanta, yeah.
What were you doing there?
Transmission control, which is a glamorized security guard.
Right.
Essentially. And it was 12-hour shifts, 8 o'clock at night till 8 in the morning. That was also part of the reason why my mental health took a toll, was because my brain... Yeah, my sleep pattern was messed up because it was a month of nights and then a month of days. And I hated it, but at the time I was saving for a mortgage And I was like, right, I'll stick the job out until I get the mortgage. Then I got the mortgage, then the first child was coming. I was like, right, okay. And then before I knew it, like 5 years passed and I hadn't done anything.
Definition of trapped.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I was trapped. And I think that's what can happen to people, especially creative people. You can get trapped in the money. You know, you have to make money. You have to get a mortgage. You have to tick the boxes. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely. Yeah. I think it's a huge problem around, because it's not really a problem on paper because you're earning money and whatever and you have a family, but there's so many people out there who are living for the weekends, and even then they can't enjoy them properly.
Yeah, or even...
Because what you do for a living is what you do the most in a given week. So it'd be preferable if you liked it, because if you don't like it, it's a long old life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really long life.
Or a short one.
Yeah. True that.
Both long and short, I think. That. In the worst ways of each. MMA never appealed to you, did it?
MMA? What, doing it like?
Yeah. If the boxing, if you had something in the boxing, because this is pivoting to your third choice about your buddy.
Yeah. I love MMA. I love boxing as well. Yeah. I love watching sport. I love sport, right? Just, I've never had an opportunity to do it or to take it serious. And I don't think it'd be too good either. Even with MMA, I'd love to do it, but I feel like I'm too long. Do you know what I mean?
An easy target.
My arms, like, you'd get them, you could tie them up like a pretzel, man. I swear I wouldn't last.
You should be able to hold people off like Scrappy Doo.
Yeah. Just hold them. I mean, I broke my knee, I think it was in 2014, playing heads and volleys in the flats. Like, and I was in goal.
You broke your knee?
I broke my knee. You know, if you get the ball in the air and you catch it, you're out of goal, somebody else is in. You know heads and volleys, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I was trying to keep the ball on the volley outside of the box to try to get it back into the box to catch it. And I overreached because my legs are too long and my knee just went in and I broke my knee. My kneecap, like, I had two surgeries on it because the kneecap went inside the joint. And
you're feeling it now?
Yeah.
That still bother you?
Oh yeah.
That must do, is it?
Yeah.
I haven't heard of a broken knee that often. Yeah. I've heard of like ligament damage in the knee area.
There was that as well, like, jeez, really heard of that. Destroyed my knee trying to get that ball.
Would you ever work in sport? Would that have ever have appealed to you? Because you love it.
Are you offering me a job here?
We'll just see where this goes.
What do you mean work in sport?
Could you work in sports media, for example? Would you talk about sport for a living?
I'd love to get badges.
Oh.
That's how you become a manager, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd love to do me badges because I feel like, because Brian Kerr never played. I feel like I could be Brian Kerr-esque. Or did he play?
He did, but more renowned as a manager.
Yeah. So I could do that. I feel like I understand sport. I feel like I could be a good football
manager. You'd be a good manager. And it could cross to other sports, not just football.
How do you mean? How could that?
Could you manage across different sports, rugby, do you think?
Not rugby. I don't understand. I very... basic understanding of rugby.
Gaelic football.
Yeah.
Was there any Gaelic football in school at all? There must have been in O'Connell's, was there?
There was, yeah. Again, the teachers knew I was crap. You know, they put me in the drama class, man. That's the reason they did that. I wouldn't have been good enough. I remember I played once and I didn't have cleats. Is that what they call it? I didn't have boots.
You spent too long in Washington, but we all know what you meant.
They just left me in defence or put me in goal, which is a terrible place to put me. And then they took me off. They knew it was bad. I was a liability in any sport. But I understood it and I love watching it and I know I can spot good. I know what good is. And I feel like there's things that I would change. I mean, I've been saying for a long time about I'm a Manchester United fan. When Amorim was in, like, I knew how to change that team. I could, like, anyone could change that team and make it a better team. But, like, I feel like I could slip in there and I could be a good manager. Do you know what I mean?
I feel
like Carrick is getting too much praise because I don't think it's too hard. Yeah. It's kind of like Real Madrid. They sort of manage themselves. You could do that with United. They could manage themselves. Just let Bruno take control. You just sit down, Carrick. You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that this would be a brilliant TV show.
Make it happen.
You're manifesting this, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to manage Manchester United.
It's not a bad club to start with, Real Madrid, actually, because very little coaching needed.
Well, yeah.
You just, you help the players out, which I think you could do. Yeah.
I think so too.
What's this MMA story?
A friend of mine done Wimp to Warrior. So SBG had, I don't know if they still do it, but it's a, it, or if they do still do it, I think it's called Train Alta. But they take,
they've changed the name, have they?
Have they? They may have. They may have.
Hey, calling all wimps. Like, yeah, that's no, a great marketing.
It wasn't good marketing. But they take amateur fighters, not even amateur fighters, beginners, and they train them for, I think it's 12 weeks. And then at the end of the 12 weeks, you have a fight. They fight each other. They kind of pair the people up that they see the most similar. And me mate done it. And just seeing him go through the entire process, I felt like I was invested myself. Like, I felt like I was...
Did you do any of the training? You just watched him?
No, I just watched him.
Yeah, purely voyeuristically.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But you really, you do kind of, especially with MMA, because it's almost life or death. Like, if it's boxing, you can take a punch and you can go down. You can, like, take a dive. But if you take a punch and you go down in MMA,
then they choke you.
They're killing you, yeah. Then. They're getting on top of you.
It's 15 punches before the referee's like, oh, yeah, you're still alive. Keep going.
Yeah, I think he's knocked out. Let's see how this goes. But yeah, so to see him get in the ring, and even that, like the fact that it's a cage and it's just closed off, and you can't, at least you can fall out of a boxing ring. You can't fall
you
out
can
of
run
a
away,
cage.
Yeah.
So I felt really invested. You don't want to see your friend hurt, but he won in the second round, and all of our mates were there. And honestly, it was one of the most exciting moments, sporting moments that I witnessed in real life, in person. It was great. It was great to see. And then you kind of wanted, you're willing, you're like, go do another fight. Do, take it on professionally now.
No.
Go to the top. It's like, nah, I've done the training, that's it. But yeah, that was amazing. That was really good. I wouldn't do that. There's lots of things that I will say that I do, that I take on, but I wouldn't do that. That's terrifying. Kill you.
Yes, too dangerous.
Kill you, like.
And lasting just, damage.
Oh, yeah.
Beyond death.
You're big on your own podcast for asking the why in anything as well.
Yeah.
Was it, you had, was it a mountaineer on?
Oh, the Bold podcast.
Your Bold podcast, yeah.
Yeah.
And you asked, the person said they were doing it for themselves.
Yeah.
You wanted to know, well, if you had found out that 100 people had accomplished what you were set out to, would you have done the same thing?
And he had to think about it. Yeah. And it was 100 Irish people. Because I was saying, does it matter? Does it mean something to be the first Irish person to do it?
Yeah.
Or to be I'm always interested by the ego. And I think there's a lot of ego in doing something like that.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think I'm also interested in the denial of ego. And people that deny the fact that they're doing it for an egotistical reason, and then I want to know why, and even that why is egotistical. They want to prove that they're not doing it for ego, which is egotistical. Do you know what
I mean? So there's no altruistic sporting achievement.
I mean, there was a marathon runner the other day, or maybe yesterday or the day before, and he was in the lead, an Irish fella, and he stopped to help someone over the finish line. That's kind of altruistic. That was sort of lovely.
Yeah.
I don't know if he ever expected to get the publicity.
You get your kudos for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But would you put your foot over the line for us just to make sure?
Yeah, and then help. Yeah. Go back and help.
Yeah.
We're stuck for time here. Your last two concern, the club you just mentioned, Manchester United, the first, the treble, and the Sunset House.
Yeah, well, I think that's where I got my love for Man United. My dad was a Manchester United fan, and it was ingrained into me. But I don't think I really understood the love for Man United until they won the treble. And I watched it through the windows, like standing on pallets, standing on a milk crate from a nearby shop, looking through the window because it was after hours and we weren't allowed inside the pub. We were kicked out after the first half, I think it was. And we watched it through the window, and it was, and not just me, like there was about 15 youngflits all peeking through the window to watch that goal go in, and it was incredible. people were coming out of their houses onto the streets. People were coming out of pubs onto the streets, giving food out. It was like, it was insane. It was similar to, I can't remember when it was. It was similar to when Ireland, was it in 2002? Were we in the World Cup?
Yeah.
Yeah, the World Cup in 2002. Like, when people come out onto the streets to bang pots and pans, I love that. I absolutely love that. I'm like, that's all they have. They have pots and pans. Let's bang shit. And that's what that was amazing when that goal went in. I didn't even want to watch because we were losing. And I think I was just sort of bored and wanted to go home at that point. But then when the first goal went in and then the second one went in, everybody, even if they weren't a fan of Man United, became a fan of Man United then.
We've about 90 seconds left here for your last one. Wayne Rooney scoring against Swansea.
Yeah. Well, I only ever went to see Manchester United play once, and that was, I can't remember when it was, but Wayne Rooney scored against Swansea. Maybe your researchers can do a quick Google on that. I think Van Gaal was the manager, and I was in the Stretford End. It was a Christmas present. The missus got me tickets got me three tickets. So me and two of the lads went.
2016?
Was it 2016? Yeah. Yeah. And that was memorable. That was really, really memorable. The first and only time I've been to Old Trafford. Okay, so I couldn't not put that in.
A Rooney winner. It's what you want to see, right?
It was like, New Year's 2016. United win 2-1. The headline, Wayne Rooney on hand to lift the mood at Manchester United.
Oh, well, it lifted
exactly how you described it.
It was amazing.
A lot of love. Eamon Cannon says, I love the honesty, fair play. Joe is a legend, says Devlad. And Dermot Keenan says, another great show, lads. It was a great show.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Thanks very
good.
Much.
Oh, well, I forgot it was live.
Good.
Deadly. Thanks for the nice messages.
That's the bill. And thanks for watching and listening this morning. That's us, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're back tomorrow morning. Keith Tracy will be here. Plenty more besides busy weekend of sport. Enjoy your Thursday. See you tomorrow, Friday.
You have to be there.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With Viagra Connect 50mg film-coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150mg tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.